This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoi, and this is The Exchange. The current cycle of presidential primaries and caucuses comes to a close in Washington, D.C. today, and the parties will turn their attention to preparing for their July nominating conventions. Yet, in the wake of these contests, many voters have been grappling with new questions about the fundamental fairness of the electoral process and whether their votes actually matter to its eventual outcome. Voter concerns range from the arcane rules of delegate selection and decisions about when contests are scheduled to the flood of super PAC money and the impact of independent voter participation in party primaries and caucuses. While New Hampshire continues to cherish its first-in-the-nation status and its high rates of voter turnout, a national conversation is brewing over whether our participatory democracy is living up to its ideals. Today on The Exchange, as part of National Public Radio series A Nation Engaged, we'll consider the question of whether your vote matters. But first, in the wake of the Orlando shooting, we'll discuss the latest from the presidential campaign trail, including Donald Trump's speech yesterday at St. Anselm College and Hillary Clinton's speech in Cleveland. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And I have three guests joining me for the show this morning. Joining me from Hanover, New Hampshire, is Joseph Bafumi. He is Associate Professor of Government at Dartmouth College. And Joe, welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you for having me, Dean.
With me in studio is Chris Galdieri. He is an Assistant Professor of Politics at St. Anselm College. Chris, it's always good to see you.
Always glad to be here, Dean.
And joining me from Boston is Steve Cuzzella. He's President of the Mass Inc. Polling Group and writes for NHPR about polling, voter demographics, and other election-related topics. Steve, thanks for joining us this morning.
Good to be here.
And gentlemen, before we turn to the topic of voting, let's spend some time discussing the latest from the presidential campaign trail in the wake of the Orlando shooting. And joining us here in studio is NHPR senior political reporter Josh Rogers. Josh covered Donald Trump's speech yesterday at St. Anselm. Josh, thanks for sitting in with us.
Anytime, Dean.
And Josh, let's start by describing the scene at St. Anselm yesterday. What did you see there?
Well, this speech was one that wasn't open to the public. There were about 100 to 200 invited guests of the Trump campaign, several dozen reporters, top Republican Party officials, GOP Chair Jennifer Horn, but relatively few of New Hampshire's most high-profile elected Republican political leaders were there. No Kelly Ayotte, no Frank Ginta, no legislative leaders. This was obviously a speech that was originally going to be a broadside against Hillary Clinton that in the wake of the Orlando shootings was retailored to be an address on security and terrorism. And so, mm-hmm. it didn't have the trappings of a Trump political event like a rally. This was an event where Mr. Trump spoke off teleprompters, which is relatively rare. There were a lot of his most staunch supporters and some protesters, but all that was pretty muted.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that some key elected officials were not there. Is the assumption that people like Kelly Ayotte were in fact invited and the other various candidates, Republican candidates for statewide office? Do we know that?
Well, it's not entirely clear who was invited and who wasn't, but I can't think of a time when the presumptive nominee of a party mm-hmm. Would use New Hampshire as a venue for a major speech and not have more of those people there.
Yeah. So why do you think this was so tightly controlled?
Well, I think that this is a volatile issue. And, I think Donald Trump and his campaign wanted to deliver a, tidy for him message on a specific topic. And, for people in the crowd, no one really knew what he was going to say. But, obviously his hardline stance on immigration policy helped fuel his rise. And, yesterday's broadened call for a ban on immigration from any country where terrorism was a threat, it made it pretty clear he's not, going to be backing away from what got him to where he now is.
Well, we have a little bit of a sound from Donald Trump's speech at St. Anselm College. Here he is talking about immigration policy.
We cannot continue to allow
thousands upon thousands of people to pour into our country, many of whom have the same thought process as this savage killer. Many of the principles of radical Islam are incompatible with Western values and institutions.
That is Donald Trump speaking yesterday at St. Anselm. So, Josh, just to kind of recap, what were the big takeaways from his speech yesterday?
Well, that he would use executive power if elected president to call for a temporary halt to immigration from any place where he perceived there would be a threat of terrorist attack coming from there. In the immediate wake of the event, there was some confusion over how he identified the shooter in the Orlando attack, as he seemed to suggest that he was in fact born abroad, which is not the case, and that was
born
in the immediate
in New York,
aftermath.
I believe, yeah.
That was something that people were pushing back on. He one thing that it was interesting to hear a Republican candidate talk about the LGBT community to the extent that he did in a way that was a little bit different, and it was interesting to hear him make the claim that he, by dint of his hardline policies on immigration and security, would be a better friend to gays, lesbian, and women than Hillary Clinton would be. And it was interesting that he did go at Clinton directly a bunch, even though he suggested that focus was lessened.
Yeah, and here is Donald Trump speaking about Hillary Clinton and also the LGBT community.
Hillary Clinton can never claim to be a friend of the gay community as long as she continues to support immigration policies that bring Islamic extremists to our country and who suppress women, gays, and anyone else who doesn't share their views or values.
That is Donald Trump again speaking at St. Anselm College yesterday. So, Josh, how does what you heard yesterday fit in the sort of range of things that Trump has said about these issues in recent months? It seems like he's sort of moved around a little bit on some of them.
Well, I mean, certainly on the border security and immigration policy, it's certainly of a piece. I mean, it broadens it. Obviously he was talking about gays and lesbians due to the location of the attack in Orlando, the nightclub. But it was interesting to talk to his supporters who tried to cast this as an indication that he is sort of pivoting to the general election. And they said that yesterday was really the kickoff of the general election. And, you know, I think it was pretty clear that his positions extend but are totally consistent with what he said all along. I mean, he is, for the record, opposed to same-sex marriage. And he also made a point of suggesting that he did not want any limitation on Second Amendment rights in the wake of this attack. And obviously that's a big contrast with Hillary Clinton's response.
Yeah. One final question, Josh, and then I'll bring in our other guests. You got to see teleprompter Donald Trump yesterday. You've also seen Donald Trump in other contexts. Sort of the differences between him as a candidate in that environment versus kind of more the off-the-cuff stuff that you've seen?
Well, I mean, the teleprompter, it's, oftentimes in his campaign rallies, it's almost like a sort of a pastiche of set pieces that are rejiggered. It was interesting to see him speak from a teleprompter. He was still pretty adamant and obviously, commanded the crowd that, the invited crowd. And it'll be interesting to see if there's more of this as we go farther down towards voting time.
Yeah, now, Chris, it seems to me that there's a correlation between how happy party officials are with the teleprompter versus how happy they are with off-the-cuff Donald Trump. I'm also interested in your general reaction to yesterday.
Yeah, I think, teleprompter Donald Trump is in keeping with statements we've heard from people like Mitch McConnell about how we want Donald to stick to a script. We don't want him to just go off book and freestyle and say whatever comes to mind. And I think that also explains the setup we saw yesterday with invited guests, people who were, they would applaud but not be, really rowdy and enthusiastic and that sort of thing. It strikes me as interesting, though, because yesterday the Republican National Committee leaked that they had advised Trump to simply extend condolences and not say anything about Orlando for a few days. And in the wake of the speech, I did not see a lot of high-profile Republicans coming out and supporting what Trump had said. And I think this is another case where he is in a lot of ways sort of off on his own, away from the I don't want to say the mainstream of his party because he's the party's nominee, but from the powers that are in the party.
So do you think that this speech hurt him or help him? I'm having trouble getting a read from the general reaction out there.
I think in terms of helping or hurting, look at the press coverage, and most of the press coverage seems to be focusing on, the insinuation he made that, President Obama knew something about this before it happened or is somehow involved in what's going on. And I think that sort of coverage is really bad because it focuses on, something that is, basically absurd and raises, again, the question of temperament and fitness for office.
Mm-hmm. Joe, let me bring in you and Steve as well. And Joel, I'll start with you. First, you're somebody whose studies voting and the kinds of issues that resonate with voters. Just your general sense of how the Orlando shooting, the speeches we heard from Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, and we'll talk more about Hillary Clinton in a moment, your sense of how that – is this sort of a reset of the presidential campaign in terms of issues, or do you think it'll swing back to some other sort of equilibrium in terms of issues?
Well, I think much of what we're hearing we've heard before. It maybe is a gearing up of the major issues. So you hear Hillary Clinton talking a lot about gun control, and you hear Donald Trump talking a lot about ending Muslim immigration. And I think what they're going to be able to do is appeal to their existing supporters. And so, in terms of who profits most from the whose positions are best able to capitalize politically on the tragic incidents of Orlando, I think it becomes sort of a wash. I think you have Hillary Clinton being able to stake a claim on issues that work well for her, and you have Donald Trump being able to stake a claim on issues that work very well for him. So I don't see anything new happening. We see Donald Trump trying to appeal to audiences that he's not doing very well with, like women voters and gays and lesbians. But probably this is not going to his message currently is not going to appeal to them much. I mean, he's just paying, just giving them very quick lip service with quick remarks. But mostly his positions have stayed the same, and I think this is just allowing us to focus on areas where they differ quite a bit in policy.
And Steve, do you think this will move the needle at all in terms of polling? Will it reset the campaign in terms of issues? What's your sense?
I don't know about reset. I mean, this is not the first high-profile terrorist incident that we've had during the campaign. You know, the thing that is different about this one is that all the rest of them took place during the primary. You can look back and see Donald Trump actually got a bump in the polls from some of the previous incidents, but when they happened, it was with a Republican primary electorate. So his reaction was appealing to a group that was perhaps more attuned to agree with or support the ideas that he was putting forth. So we don't really know yet how his reaction will appeal to the general electorate. You know, we've got some preliminary indications. The general electorate seems to be much less in favor of the idea of the so-called Muslim immigration ban. But other than that, we don't know for sure yet whether it'll be a sort of conventional, typical reaction where a security or military focus tends to benefit the Republican, or whether the specific ways that Trump is reacting will mean it's different this time.
Right. Interesting. It's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. We should also mention that Hillary Clinton gave a speech in Cleveland yesterday in which she approached the issue of the Orlando shooting as well, and she came at it from a somewhat different perspective. Here she is.
I believe weapons of war have no place on our streets. And we may have our disagreements about gun safety regulations, but we should all be able to agree on a few essential things. If the FBI is watching you for suspected terrorist links, you shouldn't be able to just go buy a gun with no questions asked.
That is Hillary Clinton speaking in Cleveland yesterday. And Josh Rogers, let me turn to you. Not surprising to hear Democrats talk about gun control. And in fact, Alan from Durham just emailed us and said, here's what he thinks Hillary Clinton's reply should be. Donald Trump can never be a friend of the gay or any other community if he continues to support a ban on – if he continues to oppose a ban on assault rifles. So Democrats not surprisingly raising the issue of gun control here. Did Trump talk about this at all?
Well, he said that Hillary Clinton wanted to take away people's guns, thereby making them more vulnerable to terrorist attacks. And it isn't surprising to hear Hillary Clinton talk about guns. This is something she put she used a lot during the primary as an issue, with some success against Bernie Sanders. not so much here in New Hampshire successful, but she is also raising the issue of not only banning so-called assault weapons, but making it impossible for people on the FBI watch list to buy guns. And that's an issue that is also like it's being brought up in Washington, and it's something that will affect our U.S. Senate race here because that's an issue that Democrats see incumbent Kelly Ayotte as vulnerable on.
And Chris, are we going to see the kind of typical divide between the Republicans and Democrats in Congress on this issue of gun control?
We are, and I think this is an issue where over the last 8 years, partisan positions have really become entrenched. If you go back 10, 15, 20 years ago, you would see some Republican support for this sort of thing and some Democratic opposition to gun legislation. Now the Democrats have become the gun control party and the Republicans have become the anti-gun control party.
And not likely to see any movement there?
Not unless one party controls both houses
based
of Congress
the election,
and the presidency.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Josh, one more question for you based on something we heard this morning, that Donald Trump had pulled the credentials of the Washington Post because he was unhappy with the reporting on some of his comments about President Obama. Can you tell listeners a little bit about, how do you deal with something like that? Are you just basically shut out? Is it temporary, do you think? What's the impact?
I don't know. I've never had my press credential pulled, but I do know that the Trump campaign has had issues with coverage in Politico as well, and they've pulled their credential. That doesn't mean you can't cover the campaign. And yesterday, you could have covered it as well on TV as in the room. I guess we'll see where this goes as far as the Trump campaign and the Post. He was particularly angry about a headline on the story that, talked about his, seeming insinuation that President Obama, may have been aware of, sort of terrorist activity.
So it was a very vague comment, right?
Yes. And so, that's what it was. And, Trump's been sort of at war and also partnered with the media quite successfully this campaign. And so, I guess we'll see where this goes.
Yeah. Is Steve, any polling come to mind with you on this issue of gun control and the general sense of how Americans feel about whether or not there should be some changes?
Yeah, I mean, some of the things that Hillary Clinton was talking about actually are quite popular even among Republicans. We did a poll in New Hampshire during the primary where we put out ideas like the exact ones you said about preventing people on watch lists from purchasing guns, and found 85% support among Republican primary voters, 75% support for universal background checks. So, some of the barriers are not specifically public opinion related. The politics get wrapped around the axle on a lot of other things, but just in terms of what people would support or what people are interested in, I think there's certainly bipartisan interest in some of the ideas that Hillary Clinton put out. So whether that'll happen or not, I think, is a totally different question. But it's not for lack of public interest or public support in some of the ideas.
Mm-hmm. And Joe, let me go to you. Your thoughts on Hillary Clinton yesterday?
Well, she's getting a lot of coverage for her remarks on guns, and that's an issue that distinguishes her from Donald Trump. But she also had a very elaborate position on the whole issue of dealing with terrorism and how to handle the broader war on terror. I think what ends up happening to her is she has this more complicated, nuanced position that doesn't really play well, isn't covered very well by the media, doesn't offer nice sound bites for people to replay. So she gets a lot of coverage on the gun control issue, which is actually fairly popular out there and probably is to her political benefit in terms of appealing to a general electorate. But she doesn't get a whole lot of coverage for her more complicated position on dealing with the war on terror as compared to Donald Trump's very succinct positions
of soundbites. Joe, we need to take a quick break. Josh, thanks so much for joining us. Next, we'll turn to the value of your vote. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I am Dean Spiliotis of SNHU, in for Laura Kanoy. Today on The Exchange, we ask, does my vote matter as part of National Public Radio's Nation Engage series? We want you to call in at 1-800-892-6477. You can send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page. And gentlemen, let's move on now to our other topic for the day, this issue of whether or not your vote matters. There are a lot of issues raised by this question. question, and hopefully we'll get to them all in the time remaining. But let me start by posing to each of you that very basic question. Does your vote matter? And you can approach this question from any perspective you'd like. Chris, let me start with you.
I think I would say that, yes, your vote matters, but it matters more in some elections than others. You know, a lot of what we've been talking about this year has been the presidency. But there are lots of other elections. You've got especially state and local offices where, you know, you're electing people who are going to make a huge difference in your day-to-day life. And yet turnout for mayor or city council or school board is very often down around, you know, the 10, 15, 20% level. And in a situation like that, the person who actually, you know, wakes up, remembers that it's election day, goes down to the Green Street Community Center or wherever and casts their ballot, is really exercising a really disproportionate influence simply because so many other people are staying home.
Yeah. And it's interesting. You mentioned, you know, everybody turns out, or not everybody, but a lot of people turn out for presidential elections. It's a very kind of emotional, high visibility enterprise. But it's those off-year elections where your property taxes or your public services, all that stuff is determined, and we get, what, 15, 17% turnout.
Yeah, in a really good year.
Yeah. Joe, your sense, does your vote matter?
I think so. And I think that what's been said is about right. It matters more in some places than others, depending on the rules of the election. It certainly, you know, one's vote doesn't count at all if one doesn't vote. And so turnout is a big deal. There are people that can vote and don't, and that's disenfranchising to them. But in general, I think people's votes count quite a bit. I think on the, you know, if we look at this primary season on the Democratic side, the populist candidate and his supporters may be a bit disappointed, but they've come a long way from 3% in the polls to being very competitive for the nomination at certain points in time. And if you look on the Republican side, which is we're kind of used to it now, but you know Donald Trump didn't look like he was going to be able to pull it off early on. He kind of came from nowhere. He was the populist candidate on the Republican side, and he actually pulled it off, spending less money than many of the other candidates. And so why that happened was because people's votes counted, right? The establishment didn't like Trump a whole lot, still doesn't. The establishment on the Democratic side was much more supportive of Clinton than Sanders. Sanders did very, very well, and Trump pulled it off by a lot. So people's votes do count. Mm-hmm.
I want to let our listeners know we're discussing a question that NPR stations around the country are exploring this week as part of the Nation Engage series. Does my vote matter? And you can call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. The email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Steve, let me get your initial thoughts on whether or not you think our votes matter.
Yes, I'd say they do, and particularly in New Hampshire, they matter more than almost anywhere else. You know, the votes that are cast in New Hampshire go to the First in the Nation primary is certainly one that everybody thinks of, but, New Hampshire then is often close in presidential elections, you know, meaning the presidential campaign spent a lot of time and energy in New Hampshire in the general election phase as well. Gubernatorial, Senate, congressional races all tend to be close. So, you know, there's lots of other states, either because they vote later in the primary after all said and already decided, or because they're in, you know, deeply partisan areas and gerrymandered congressional districts where it really doesn't matter. You know, the winner has already pretty much got it locked up by a 25 or 30 point margin. That happens almost never in New Hampshire these days. You know, it's almost always a close contest, even before you get down to talking about the, you know, local municipal kinds of elections. You know, New Hampshire voters, I'd say, have it good in terms of the amount of impact that they have and the amount of attention they receive.
Chris, let me turn to you. Steve mentioned that our vote matters, especially in New Hampshire. And before we get to unpacking some of the larger problems with the system, let's talk specifically about New Hampshire and why you think we are such a civically engaged state.
I think a lot of it comes down to the fact that there are just so many opportunities for civic engagement in this state. You have something like 400 towns. You have over 400 members of the state legislature. You have town councils. You have mayors. You have the executive council. So there are all these access points into politics in New Hampshire that you don't see in a lot of other states. And I think that means that if you are someone who is civic minded, or if you are someone who has a problem with the way trash is collected in your town, or thinks there needs to be a stoplight there, you have lots of ways to do something about it.
Joe, your sense of New Hampshire's civic culture.
I think it's a strong and healthy one, and I think there are a variety of reasons. In part, it may be socioeconomics, higher education levels, for example. In part, it may be relative to some states, not all. It may also be the political history and traditions here. And, you know, town hall meetings are very enfranchising to people, very empowering to people, and there's a long history of that. And so that gets them civically involved. And then, of course, having the first primary is a big deal and gets people to the polls. They know that, you know, voters know that they're making an important message that people hear throughout the country, that the media covers quite a bit when they vote on that presidential primary day, and they build a lot of momentum for candidates that they favor. So they see the importance of it, and they get out there and they vote.
Yeah, you know, certainly I think part of the civic tradition is tied to the first in the nation primary, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But let's start to unpack some of these problems that we've been hearing about in the media and from some voters around the country. We hear frequently from Donald Trump and some voters that the system is rigged. Steve, first of all, what do they mean by that? And do you think the system is rigged? Is that a fair criticism?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, on the Democratic side, the assertion came initially from the fact that Hillary Clinton started the contest with quite a significant delegate lead. So superdelegates, you know, party officials and, you know, a variety of other people can decide who they want to support. And almost all of them, right out of the gate, were already with Hillary Clinton. So she started off in all of the charts and all the websites with what appeared to be this big lead. So, you know, that is what started it. It's I'd say mutated into a lot of less accurate complaints about the primary process on the Democratic side. You know, Hillary Clinton has now won more delegates too. It's not only because of the superdelegates. She's won more votes, you know, by quite a wide margin. So, by any metric you want to measure it, she has won. But the narrative, I think, took hold when it was kind of a fair question, you know, whether or not superdelegates are a good way to establish the front runner before anyone's even voted.
Gentlemen, let's go to the phones, and calling in from Nashua is Chris. Chris, welcome to the Exchange.
Good morning. Thank you.
Sure.
One of the things I've always been fascinated by is the concept of an open primary. And essentially what we saw this year was a lot of people who were never Republicans or, you know, maybe were leaning that way but had never really registered piled into the Republican primary, and it looks to me like they vastly distorted the end result from what it would have been if, you know, essentially the traditional Republican and traditional Republican values had essentially, you know, driven the train. So I've never understood why we actually allow open primaries, because to me that's kind of like allowing the general public to nominate who your priest, you know, who your rabbi is, even when, you know, they're not members of the, you know, the congregation that you are. So, you know, I think we've seen really the limits of an open primary, in my opinion.
Thanks, Chris. That's a great question. And in fact, that was something we were going to talk about in the context of political parties. And Chris Galdieri, let me turn to you. We've heard some complaints among Republicans in particular that the process was kind of hijacked by people who are not party regulars. Mm-hmm. These parties are private. What do you think about this idea? It's certainly something we can apply in New Hampshire, where independent voters can vote in primaries. What do you think about Chris?
Yeah, it's a very fair question and a fair criticism. I think the problem here is that these are decisions that parties make. They do it based on their guess about what's going to work for them in their particular state. Usually the thinking is, you know, well, an open primary is a way to appeal to moderate voters and to pick candidates who will do well in a general election. So especially if you're, let's say you're the Democrat Party in a pretty Republican state, you might think we need to have an open primary so we can pick someone who can win a general election in our state that leans the other way. I think what we're seeing in this presidential election amongst Republicans, but also among some Democrats, are complaints that these open primaries have really diluted the voice of party members. And I think this is one of those things where there's no right answer to that question. It's just, you know, how things worked out this year, essentially.
I want to let our listeners know we're discussing a question that public radio stations around the country are exploring this week as part of the Nation Engage series, and we're discussing, does my vote matter? And I have with me three guests, Joe Bafumi, Associate Professor of Government at Dartmouth College, Chris Galdieri, Assistant Professor of Politics at St. Anselm College, and Steve Cozella, President of Mass Inc. Polling Group. And Joe, let me turn to you with an email that we just received from Ron. Ron says, my individual vote doesn't matter unless the election is decided by a single vote. Unless this is the case, the outcome of the election was not affected by my voting. If my vote doesn't affect the outcome, why should I vote? And I know this is something that political scientists often talk about, kind of rational non-voting. So just your reaction to Ron's email.
Sure. Well, you know, if everyone thought that way and no one voted, then the one person who did would you know, make all the difference in the world. It is true that it's rare that anyone would be the pivotal voter, that one voter that makes the difference. Those elections, the outcomes of those elections do decide the winner. It's just rare that they're so incredibly close that one person can make the difference. But when a whole lot of people think that they can't be pivotal, therefore don't decide to vote, they're just really giving the choice to those who do decide to vote. And that's how turnout is very important.
Chris, you want to jump in?
One thing to bear in mind is that every year there really are elections that turn out to be a tie. There aren't a lot of them, but every year after Election Day, just Google for, coin flip election. So people for sheriff or mayor or whatever, and they do a coin toss or they draw cards or they do rock, paper, scissors. And so in those cases that do happen more often than you'd think, it really would have been, if Ron had turned out, he would have been the deciding vote. The other thing to bear in mind is that I think there's also value to voting, not just in terms of, well, do you get to be the tie-breaking vote, but just the civic act of voting has value in and of itself. There are a lot of people who were excluded from voting for a very long swath of American history. And so if you are African American or if you are a woman, being able to vote is not just, a voice in the process. It's a sign that you're actually fully a member of the body politic. And I don't think that should be discounted.
Yeah, there's an efficacy component to it. Gentlemen, let's go back to the phones. We have Douglas calling in from Berlin. Douglas, welcome to the exchange.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a Republican. I am voting for Trump. Not because of anything, but, I am a Republican. He does not share a lot of my values because I'm a born-again Christian, and I believe that, there's no king but God. And so, therefore, Trump is really, the only pick I would have. Hillary is actually should not even be running for president because she's excluded. 1 Timothy 2, we talked about that, holy. So, I think we should all, our votes should count. And I think that if you're not registered to vote, they should allow for that. Because I think that if more Republicans just voted and got their voice in, there'd be more of a Republican voice, and my voice would be heard as well.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Douglas. Steve, let me get your reaction to the caller, and also maybe a little bit more generally about this issue of religious voting or social conservatives. It's not something we typically talk a lot about in New Hampshire.
Yeah, I mean, New Hampshire has one of the least conservative, evangelical votes in the country, both in the primary and the general. That's been true for a while now. So, but I think the caller brings up something interesting, which is that a lot of the vote choices are being driven by who people don't like rather than who people necessarily identify with. He said that he's not necessarily on board with everything Trump thinks, but, is very much opposed to Hillary Clinton. And the latest polling out of New Hampshire shows that almost nobody likes both of them. And there's a very strong relationship between who you like and who you're going to vote for. In a lot of elections elsewhere, a lot of elections in New Hampshire, there will at least be some crossover. 10 or 20% will, I like Hillary Clinton, but I'm going to vote for Donald Trump, feel that way. In this election, there's almost none of that in New Hampshire. It's almost entirely mutually exclusive who voters like. And that's a big part of what's making up voter decisions. I'd like to go back to one earlier point, too, which is which is whether primaries are a process or an election. You know, I think voters tend to view it as we should get to pick who we're going to vote for president. And I think the caller's point was that parties should get to choose who they're going to put up. And that is the fundamental conflict in some way of what's going on here. You know, we're still hearing talk about whether or not Trump could potentially be replaced on the ticket. But there'd be a lot of logistical complications to closing all the primaries, not the least of which is lots of states don't even have party registration. But the idea is still a good one an interesting one and worth discussing whether or not this is something that the party should choose or that the voters should choose.
Yeah, Joe, let me ask you following up on something that Steve said. This idea that people often vote based on what they don't like or who they don't like rather than some sort of positive rationale for a vote. And it gets to the sort of larger issue of voting based on policy versus voting based on emotion and identity. Kind of your sense of how that breaks out in the electorate.
Yeah, I think, you know, voters often have a number of different considerations when they go into the voting booth. And some of it is issue-based and some of it is more affect, just a general emotional feeling, positive or negative, toward a candidate. Or this cycle, it seems for many in the middle, it's more who they dislike the least. In terms of which is most important, I think, for particular voters depends on, you know, who they are and what their life is like. There are single issue voters on abortion. There are all people who really focus on policy in big and important ways. And then there are other people for whom there really isn't any policy that that is particularly important to them. And it's for those folks that I think affect and emotional feelings toward the candidates becomes more important. So there are a lot of considerations out there. Any single voter could have multiple considerations. Policy is a big one, but sometimes it's just favorability and a gut feeling about these people that determines the votes of some folks out there.
Mm-hmm. And Chris, let me ask you about kind of one issue that's important to Democrats, maybe tangential a little bit to the larger discussion of who chooses candidates, this issue of the superdelegates on the Democratic side. Do you think we're finally seeing the end of that experiment? I think it started in 1984, something like that.
That's a good question. I think, you know, I don't know that we're at the end of it. I think we're hearing some chatter about it. But I think getting rid of them would require a lot of high profile or low profile but powerful and influential Democrats to give up a little bit of that power. And so I'm not sure that that's something we're likely to see. On the other hand, I think what a lot of superdelegates have not enjoyed is the focus on their role in the last couple of elections. I think if it were left to superdelegates, they would like to have no attention to what they're doing. It's the incentives are all for them to support whoever their state supports and support the eventual nominee. They don't want to get phone calls at home or angry posts on their Facebook walls saying, how can you support Clinton? You should be supporting Sanders or vice versa. So I guess that's where I see that settling down.
Well, we are about to take one more break. Coming up, we'd like to hear from you about whether or not you think your vote matters. We're taking part in Public Radio's Nation Engage series exploring the question, does my vote matter? I'm Dean Spiliotis, and this is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today, along with other member stations around the country, we ask, does my vote matter? This is part of Public Radio's Nation Engage series. You can call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. I have three guests with me for the remainder of the show. Steve Cozella is president of MassInc Polling Group. He also writes for NHPR about polling, voting, voter demographics, and other topics related to New Hampshire's presidential primary. Joseph Bufumi, associate professor Professor of Government at Dartmouth College, and Chris Galdieri, Assistant Professor of Politics at St. Anselm College. And gentlemen, let's turn now to this issue of the fairness of the primary and caucus schedule. It's something we always hear a lot of complaints about. Sounds like it. Certainly the Republicans are going to take this up at their convention, perhaps the Democrats as well. And Steve, let me turn to you first. You wrote a very interesting article about this idea of possibly pairing New Hampshire with Massachusetts. So let me get your reaction first to the potential for reform of the schedule.
Right. I mean, that's one of the ideas that was put forth by as a way to potentially change up the Republican process. The idea of pairing Iowa with a state near it, New Hampshire with a state near it. And in 2022, the one that was put forth was Massachusetts in this potential plan. And my piece was basically analyzing how it would work and the surprising ways that it could potentially work. The reasons being that a lot of the media is already purchased in Boston, you know, so you're already hitting a good chunk of the voters in Massachusetts. The geography that you're then responsible for is not huge. You know, one of the arguments that's often put forth about, you know, why the primary should stay in New Hampshire is just the ability to get from place to place. You know, it's not California, it's not Texas, where you'd have to put just an enormous number of miles in to get in front of a lot of voters. So not saying that pairing is necessarily a good idea, but if it were to be done, there's a lot of potential benefits to it.
Mm-hmm. And Joe, let me get your reaction to the schedule in general. And I do hear from people who are critical of the pairing idea that they're afraid we'll end up with basically a Boston primary instead of a regional primary.
Yeah, you can imagine a situation like that where Massachusetts, being a bigger, more populous state, would get more media attention, and that would take some away from New Hampshire, which New Hampshire wouldn't like. But it might also, some would say, might also remove the retail politics element of having New Hampshire and Iowa for smaller states where people get to know these candidates better. But that's one of a lot of ideas that's been in the news lately. There have been several over presidential cycles going back quite a long time that thought about ways to make the schedule more fair to states who feel like they've been left behind. Certainly, the current schedule works very well for Iowa and New Hampshire, a couple other states, Nevada, South Carolina right now. But a whole lot of other states have wanted to have some of that attention. Small states say, you know, they could work just as well. Bigger states say, hey, we're bigger, more diverse. Why not give us some attention? So this is something that's been debated quite a bit. Probably one thing you'll see is, you know, this cycle you might see something changing with Nevada being the western state. They might look to another state because there have been complexities with Nevada. In terms of whether or not Iowa or New Hampshire, their status would change, every cycle there are people who attempt that. So far, there have been challenges at varying degrees of success, but so far the main institution of Iowa and New Hampshire has held together. There seems to be sort of an inertia there, and there are some interests to keeping it just as such, and so it's been very difficult to change. If it does change, I imagine you could see turnout being lower in New Hampshire, for example. In terms of, you know, getting back to an earlier point, in terms of enfranchisement and the superdelegates, so, you know, the Democratic Party has had this long struggle with whether or not they should nominate somebody who is electable or nominate someone who really speaks to the progressive or liberal wing of their party. And I think that the superdelegates are a phenomenon that we see as an outcome of that debate. It was back in 68 when people were very disappointed that the nominee, Humphrey, was someone who hadn't won a single primary or caucus, wasn't even entered into them. And it was then that people were upset that essentially party bosses were picking the nominees. And so superdelegates came about they eliminated the notion of party bosses being able to select nominees altogether, and they went very much in the populist direction and felt they went too far because they were nominating candidates who were populist but were not appealing to the general electorate well enough. And it is from then that superdelegates came about to try and allow for a greater degree of electability. Over time, it's grown, and then it was about 20% in 2008. Now it's lower. It seems that we'll probably have about 15% superdelegates, and the efforts by Bernie Sanders are to make it even less. And so we'll have to see where that goes from here. But it's really essentially a struggle of the Democratic Party to choose between electability, someone like maybe Hillary Clinton might be more electable, arguably, versus someone who really appeals to the progressive and the populist elements of the party like Sanders did.
Sanders, right. Well, Peg emailed us in, and she was not happy. She said, this year I felt my vote did not count. The old establishment DNC decided which candidates they would anoint. The superdelegates stood with their choices, and the votes of the people didn't change anything. Unfortunately, their choices for candidates don't match the wishes of the people here in New Hampshire. I'm in my 70s and will now leave the Democratic Party and remain an independent. And Peg in Concord, thanks for that very passionate email. Gentlemen, let's go back to the phones. And joining us is Karen in Lebanon. Karen, welcome to the exchange.
Hi, Professor Stiliotis.
Hi.
How are you?
Oh, Karen Leo, correct?
That's right.
I recognize your voice. Go ahead, please.
Well, so I know it's tempting, especially like in the Upper Valley, we are very Democratic these days. And so I know it can be really tempting for people to think that their vote doesn't count, you know, sort of there's already, we know it's going to go Democratic, so what's the point of voting? And I always remind people that while the Upper Valley may be, you know, Lebanon may go Democratic, but in when you look at it from the congressional district, for example, we need a strong turnout in the Democratic areas to cancel out Republican strongholds in other parts of the district. So I think there's a lot of ways you can come at this question, and that's one way that I like to encourage people that even though they may feel like they're safe and their Democratic candidate at the top of the ticket might be safe in their particular area, that their vote still matters a lot because it cancels out a vote essentially somewhere else. So that's, I think, just another little piece of the equation.
Thanks, Karen. Good to hear from you. Let's go back to the phones, and we have Ann in Peterborough joining us. Ann, welcome to the exchange.
Thank you. I just have one question. I've always wondered, the popular vote seems to always outnumber the actual final vote. Why can't we have a popular vote be the determining factor?
Okay. Chris, I'll let you take that. That's a good philosophical question, and also feel free to respond to Karen as well.
In terms of the Electoral College?
Yeah, I think she's talking about why don't we just have popular,
sure,
you know, popular vote should determine everything.
Well, a lot of it comes down to what Professor Bafoumi was saying earlier. A lot of it is inertia. The Founding Fathers in their infinite wisdom created the Electoral College back in the late 1780s. And with minor tweaks, that's what we've still got. I suspect we don't use it in quite the manner they envisioned. They probably didn't see it as being so tightly tied to the popular vote. I think the main reason that we still use the Electoral College, which, you know, no other country has anything that resembles this anywhere in the world, is simply because it works well enough most of the time. And those situations where one candidate wins the popular vote but loses the Electoral College only seem to happen every 125 years or so. And so I think you would need to see a string of elections where the popular and electoral votes go in opposite directions before you would really see a serious movement to reform the system.
Yeah, Steve, let me get your thoughts on this as well, moving to the popular vote potentially.
Yeah, this is one of the areas where I would guess people on other NPR stations will be having a very different discussion, because in New Hampshire, it certainly is the case that your vote counts, even though there's the Electoral College system. But in states that are in Massachusetts, where I currently am, it really doesn't. You know, I mean, the Democrat is going to win Massachusetts usually by 20 or 25 points, whether you really run much of a campaign or not. So the effect that the Electoral College has is that all of the attention is focused pretty much on about a dozen, maybe 13 or 14 states. And even within that, only the swing voters, because all you have to do is win each state by one vote, and you win all the electoral votes in most cases from that state. So there's no incentive to win it by two votes or 10 votes or a million votes. It doesn't do you any sort of incremental good. So you know, the effect is that anybody who doesn't fit that description, a voter who is persuadable in a state that's going to be close, really doesn't get much, if any, attention from the presidential campaign. You know, all that really happens in Massachusetts, for instance, is the people buy media in the Boston market to try to hit New Hampshire and raise money and send volunteers. There's no actual campaigning that takes place here because, again, it doesn't matter if Trump were to campaign really hard here, pick up another couple tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of vote and close the margin. It makes absolutely no difference. And that's where the Electoral College really changes the question of whether or not my vote counts in another state outside of a swing state.
Well, we have a number of listeners emailing us, and they seem pretty unhappy with the process. We have Will writing in and saying, I continue to vote, typically Democratic, but feel it has little effect. The superdelegate issue has rigged the Democratic primary so strongly that voting in the primary just leads to frustration. And if you look at the presidential candidates we're likely to be presented with, it's depressing. Who wants to vote for people with such high unfavorability ratings? And Lynn writes in from Sanborn and says, the process is so out of date, a modern country's voters actually have their votes count. In the USA, our November vote doesn't count. Our primary vote counts, but not our November count. And Mark wrote in to complain that since the nominating process has left us with a choice between a reality TV celebrity and a candidate who is the spouse of a former president and may be indicted, isn't the nomination system seriously broken? So thanks to our listeners for expressing their thoughts on whether or not their vote matters. And Joe, let me turn to you. We're hearing a lot of frustration from voters. What do you think the likelihood is that the system could possibly be reformed in a way that will make people happier? I mean, you've talked a little bit before about some of the compromises that went into the system over the years. But where do you think we're headed with this?
Well, it's hard to say. People debate about reform all the time. Generally, much less happens than doesn't. Generally, there's status quo winning out. In some of what's being debated now would actually be less enfranchising than the status quo. Things like making primaries and caucuses closed to just registered partisans, right? This is something that you can imagine Cruz's delegates are going to be fighting for, and some other folks that are very disappointed with the Trump nomination. But of course, Trump will have many more delegates, and so he'll be able to counter that. Not all of his delegates are necessarily even Trump supporters, though, and that itself is an issue that will be debated, and people will consider reform. So, you know, one point is, you know, reform is always discussed. That's generally inertia or status quo wins out. To the extent that there are reforms, look for some people to be looking toward reforms that actually empower voters less rather than more, arguably. Certainly with closed primaries, that would be the case for unaffiliates, right? They would have less capacity to choose and decide outcomes. It's hard to know, though, where this cycle will what sort of reforms will be produced this cycle. On the Democratic side, I think you will see a big fight, given that it's taken hold in the national discourse, a big fight over superdelegates. They've already looked to be less of them for this cycle than in previous cycles by about 5%. And you can bet that the Sanders delegates, and there will be quite a few of them there, will fight to reduce that even more so that candidates like him have a better shot in the future.
Let's go back to the phones one more time. We have Bob calling in from Amherst. Bob, welcome to the exchange.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Whenever a politician runs for office, they encourage everybody to vote. They plead with everybody to vote. But yet, when the Supreme Court is up for voting on a justice, they withhold their votes. I don't think they're leading by good example. I think it's a paradox, and they don't practice what they preach.
But could you, Bob, when you say they, you mean the members of Congress, or who are we talking about when you say they don't vote?
We're talking about the Senate.
The Senate, okay.
The Republicans in the Senate are withholding their vote. They refuse to vote. And I don't think it's a good example for the American people to have our leaders say, we're not going to vote on this.
Mm-hmm. Chris, let me get your reaction and then also your general thoughts on reform.
Well, what strikes me is that the Supreme Court has made a number of decisions in recent years about the Voting Rights Act, about voter ID laws, that have had a pretty big impact on the way we're conducting elections. And I think whomever winds up filling the vacancy on the Supreme Court left by the death of Justice Scalia will go on to have a huge say in how we conduct elections in the future.
Mm-hmm. And your general thoughts about reform?
In terms of reform, I think, you know, good reforms would focus on making it easier to vote, on lowering the costs of becoming a voter, getting registered, of casting a ballot. You know, we're seeing some states out west that have moved to automatic voter registration, others that have moved to voting by mail exclusively or in large part. So I think that may be the way of the future. I think you might see people wanting to just be able to vote from the comfort of their couch rather than having to get up and go to a school gymnasium and cast a ballot there after standing in line for an hour.
Mm-hmm. Well, Steve, we're almost out of time, but I'd like to get your thoughts. You know, what kinds of things are you going to be looking at in your polling in terms of voters over the next few months on some of these issues?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of reform, just to wrap that one up, I think sure. It's tempting to view stuff that happens in the halls of the DNC and in smoke-filled back rooms, you know, metaphorically, as preventing the will of the people somehow. But I think it's important to remember that Hillary Clinton won the process fair and square by votes in addition to superdelegates. It wasn't just the superdelegates that have thwarted the will of the people so far. It did appear that way at the beginning, but she really has rolled up more votes than anyone else at this point. What we'll be looking for in going forward, pertinent to this question, is whether or not people do turn out or don't turn out. You know, we've got right now, in terms of the polling, two of the most unpopular. I think it actually now may be the two most unpopular candidates that have ever been nominated or will be nominated for president. So the effect that has on turnout is a bit uncertain. You know, and Donald Trump is not really on a lot of the traditional spectrums that allow you to sort of predict what voters will do and how they'll react to him. So those are going to be some of the challenges going into the fall in terms of figuring out which way the race is breaking mm-hmm. down.
Well, we are out of time. I know we're going to be watching to see the impact of the convention season on the electoral process. I'd like to thank my guests. Joe, thanks so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
That's Joseph Bafumi, Associate Professor of Government at Dartmouth College. He joined us from Hanover. Chris, always a pleasure to talk with you.
Glad to be here, Dean.
That's Chris Galdieri, Assistant Professor of Politics at St. Anselm College. And Steve, thanks so much for sharing your insights this morning.
My pleasure.
That's Steve Cuzzella, President of the Mass Inc. Polling Group. Steve also writes for NHPR on a variety of election-related topics. He joined us from Boston. And my thanks also to NHPR's senior political reporter, Josh Rogers, for joining us earlier in the show. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Jessica Hunt. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy.